This is Gorgeous Lives, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Kate Mayfield, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much. It's nice of you to do this.
That's wonderful. Your book is a memoir. It's called The Undertaker's Daughter, and your father was, as the title would indicate, an undertaker in Jubilee, Kentucky.
It's a very small town on the southern border of the eastern part of the state, about an hour from Nashville, Tennessee. It's set in the 60s, 70s, and as everything in the South, in a small town, it's about 10 years behind. So it's even slower than you might imagine. And my father rolled us into town in his DeSoto from another town in Kentucky and set up shop in an old house because he wanted to own his own funeral home. He'd been an embalmer and a funeral director in the other town where I was born. And the house was a big, sprawling, three-story home, and the funeral home was on the first floor, the ground floor here. And we lived on the top floor. And that was my life for the entire period of my childhood.
But you in particular were very close with your father, very attuned to what he did. And it seemed to me in the beginning of the book that you, like me, it's sort of like your family and what went on in your family, and especially in your father's life, was bigger than anything that happened outside the home.
I think it was.
Yeah.
That's very astute, actually. I hadn't really thought of that. But yes, it was my life. Although I was quite active in school and school events and certainly church, where we were made to go to church every Sunday and Sunday night, that was on the peripheral. It mm-hmm. was because the funeral home at that time was also a social house.
Mm-hmm.
So when we weren't busy, the men about town who would normally go to a coffee shop would come by and have coffee, especially during the winter when it was cold outside and no one wanted to be out. And during the summer, they'd have a Coca-Cola. And so it was a playground for me. And I spent a lot of time just observing people. And, of course, when there were funerals and when there was visitation, the place was packed with people and, you know, lining up at the door and coming in, paying the respects, sitting around, talking. And I had a particular view, and later my younger sister and I together had a particular view of what was going on downstairs because of the way the landing of the staircase was. So we could peek down and literally look at the top of the heads of the people who were sitting below. I would also see them alive and then dead the next day.
Yeah.
So that is a particular view.
Yeah. Yes, and you, I mean, went into the embalming room because the embalming was done on the premises. The bodies of the deceased were brought to, you know,
oh, yes, the town was so small and still is so small. There was no morgue or anything like that, but the bodies were brought directly from either the hospital, but more often from the home, to the funeral home. And it was a place where the family and of the deceased was welcome. I mean, many nights they would spend the night downstairs, the families of the deceased, and go home the next morning and change and freshen up and then come back, you know. My father didn't really... he tried to phase that out because that was a lot. I mean, our lives were you know, overtaken by this anyway, but to have someone there 24 hours a day for two nights in a row was a bit much.
Because your parents were very strict about sort of the rules and regulations of a viewing and a funeral. And everyone had the timing, and kids were not welcome.
They had to be.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to, well, we weren't welcome. The children of whoever of the town were welcome. But, yeah, they had to be to make the business work.
Mm-hmm.
The atmosphere that a funeral director, at least my father, tried to make and did was of complete reverence. And this is the family's time. and this is the time to honor the deceased in any way that they wanted to. Which is sometimes really interesting. So when you walk into a funeral home today, I mean, I know a lot of people still haven't done that, but you don't want to hear children running up and down the stairs or even walking overhead. You don't want to hear, you don't want to have the odor of the dinner that was just coming
sounds
down,
of
you know.
Vibrant life.
I mean, flowers are very, very strong, but not strong enough to overtake fried liver or whatever.
That's so funny. I was thinking liver too.
Liver and onions,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Which I don't like,
yes.
But anyway. So it was important for my father's business for us, the children, to be invisible.
Mm-hmm. And your father, that definitely comes through, that your father had belief, almost, you know, like a Shakespearean actor, in that this space be held for these people. Kind of to his cost,
yes.
Because, you know, there was fallout for him emotionally afterwards of, like, holding this structure up.
Yes.
But for your mother, it sounded like it was business, you know. I mean,
yes.
if people lived longer, this was the problem, you know?
Yes, it was, yeah. For her. She was very businesslike,
yeah.
About the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I think to this day, she still doesn't really think, well, you know, what's the big deal? You grew up in a funeral home, so what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, right. But it's, you know, and I'll also say that it's one thing to choose to be in the industry and another to be born into
yeah.
the industry.
Yeah.
Those are two completely things
yeah.
entirely.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have no choice.
No.
There were a lot of severe politicians in that small town.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there are everywhere, in every mm-hmm. small town. But these were particularly fierce.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted things done their way, and they wanted him to do things their way. And my father wasn't like that. He wanted to do things his way. It was his business. He felt that he should run his business as he saw fit. And they didn't like it, and he didn't like them. And thus began I wouldn't say war, but a very long Hatfield and McCoy
yes.
Feud.
Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, wasn't it? I would definitely call it a long, long burning feud. So that sort of started, you know, with the town elders kind of when you first came to town.
Yes.
And there was... Because also to further set the scene, this is a small southern town, and while the Ku Klux Klan doesn't come into it, there is palpable racism, there is segregation.
They were near.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like
they were
at the edges.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Very near.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And some of your rebellion around those issues we'll come to in a little bit. But your father, relatively early on, found an ally.
Yes.
And it was kind of because at the time, undertakers were the only people with sort of a big old body-sized car.
Yes,
so
that was very important
yeah.
at the time. It was very important in the business at the time. There were no emergency services. So if a person needed to go to the hospital or even to their doctor and they couldn't get there, they called the funeral home.
Yeah.
So, they of their choice. And at that time, my father represented a new choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was busy feeling his way through the group of people who were going to be for him and were going to try him and for the long-established older undertaker who was there. And there was fierce competition. It was serious.
Yeah, it was like, and bedside, you know, sort of wrangling.
Yes,
and
wrangling
pressuring
at the
families
hospital and pressure. Yes, severe pressure at the hospitals on the family of their dying son, mother, father. There was a woman who, an elderly woman, who called my father out of the blue in the middle of the night and said, I think I gotta go to the hospital, you know. And he picked her up. He didn't know very much about her. but she answered the door, and she was dressed head to toe in red, even in the middle of the night. I mean, red hat, red shoes, red gloves, red coat, red stockings, red underneath. And took her to the hospital and was, and you know, my father was very charming and very charismatic and very helpful, mm-hmm. always wanting to be of service. And it was genuine too. And so she was taken with him, and he was in the hospital for another reason while she was still there in her room, getting better. And he stopped by to say hello. And he also did one thing that was very important, which was send her red carnations. And he did that because, now this was calculated, the other undertaker, his rival, I know this sounds crazy, but he was sending red roses to the families of the people who my father had picked up and taken to the hospital.
And by rights, those were his bodies.
Yes, and so he was trying to get the attention back to him. And so my father said, well, I'm just not going to let this happen this time. He said, I can't afford a dozen roses, but I can afford red carnations. So he sent her some red carnations, and wouldn't you know it, she didn't even like roses. She likes carnations. So that kind of sealed it. Yes. And from then on, they became friends, very, very good friends. And as you said, an ally. And she helped to introduce him to people he didn't know and to farmers who were her customers. And they became very, very close friends. I would say more like a mother-son relationship. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, because he was very dutiful to her. And she, you know, she was, as well as offering her patronage, she did want the company. Because it struck me that she was quite a lonely woman. She was a woman of, you know, outstanding. You couldn't fault her.
No.
But people didn't like her.
Right. Well, they were jealous of her.
Exactly. A successful woman.
She was at that time, yeah. For a woman to own her own business, a fertilizer business, mm-hmm. She was in agriculture, and she'd become very, very successful by very hard graft. She worked very hard, and she sacrificed a lot. And at the time that she met my father, her own dear, beloved brother had recently died. So she was grieving. Mm. When she met him,
there was a hole there that he stepped into.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, so and you were also part of this sort of patronage and having to parade and in front.
We were some strange trio, really. I mean, I don't know why. Again, I think it may be the age that I met her. My younger sister was too young to have a conversation with her, and she was profoundly deaf, and you had to scream to be heard, and she screamed at you. So it was very nerve-wracking.
And all in red, very eccentric.
Yeah, red, and, yeah. And, you know, this gruff voice that I can't even pretend to do, and southern, gruff southern voice. And and so my older brother and sister were older, and they, you know, and she was into the kind of little girl thing with the petticoats and the black patent leather shoes and my ringlets or whatever kind of hairstyle I had. And we just, she just took a shine to me. And so my father would take me to visit her, and I'd have to dress up and make sure everything was perfect and take her a gift. And we exchanged gifts, and it was holidays and birthdays and special occasions. And then suddenly just, you know, out of the blue, she'd say, I want to see her.
Bring me the child.
Bring me the child.
Bring the girl. Command performance. Off you go. Dressed up. Well, and also, I mean, for your mother, whose sense of propriety and how things, you know, comme il faut, you know, how things had to be done, that really went to the fore. So you had to be starched and pressed and ironed and coiled,
yes.
And sprung and,
yes.
You know, marched, you know, before you were marched there. That, it seemed like, as much as, I mean, your father sounded fantastically fun.
Yes,
as
he was.
I mean, his outrageously peacocked,
yes.
You know,
yes.
Dapper Dan of a man in,
yes.
This town, you know.
Yes.
And, you know, and also, you know, all he really created all the people who worked around him were really quite loyal, and worked in the same way that he did. You know,
he trained them to be that way, and if they weren't, then they were gone. So they knew they had to work as a team, and he was the leader. And it was a theatrical production in the nicest way possible.
Yes.
But that's what a funeral in the South is like. Everything is precise. Everything is planned ahead and orchestrated to whatever the family wanted, which was usually the same thing. A few hymns, maybe someone sing a sad song, and a preacher. And it was always the same, but it's slightly different depending on the family.
Mm.
So, but those things, you know, I learned that they didn't happen by themselves. There was a lot going on underneath the pond, you know, with the water, with the ducks and the just swimming like hell and floating on the surface.
Yeah, and that performance part of his life was very much to the fore. And it struck me as that there was a camaraderie, just like there is, as you say, in an acting troupe. But there was also camaraderie because, you know, so you're there. It is a business, and it's necessary, but it is sort of set aside. People think, you know, like, you're a bit creepy, you know, because you work with the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, there's the camaraderie of that kind of group, you know, sort of being in that Undertaker's cast,
yes,
if you will.
I think that mostly people don't want to think about how their loved one actually got in the casket and how they became to look the way they did after being dead for hours, after rigor mortis, after the body starts to change and decompose, which is why they wanted to see them embalmed. But there was never a question about embalming, ever. That was what they did. And so my father was there to help them not have to deal with that.
Yeah.
And there was no need to.
Mm-hmm.
What they needed to deal with was the event that was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
And for that to be as comfortable as possible, though it's never comfortable, but to make them feel as if this was smooth.
Mm-hmm. And the proper respect.
Yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, because that performance aspect of your father's life was so strong, and so much of what he did was for other people.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's always, you know, it's not uncommon for performers, you know, and then afterwards you sort of have to let go and go a little crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And those created a lot of that action in sort of alcohol and other women sort of created a lot of tension in your home.
Yes, it did. It took a long time in writing this book to figure out, to try to work out, you know, why he was the way he was. And it's like everyone else, it was complicated. People are very, very complicated. And he was, I think a lot of it had to do with being in trauma from his World War II experience when he was just a young man, just over, just almost a boy. And he had a terrible time there, as many did, most did. And there was no help when he came back. Mm-hmm. And he began drinking. He never drank until he went to the war.
Mm-hmm.
And
which his
that's
brother
when it started.
Also did not survive.
His brother did not survive, no. About the adultery and the women, that's really hard for me to speak about because all I know are the facts, but I don't know the motivation. It's what we can assume is maybe he felt trapped. He was on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There were no pagers. There were no mobile phones. The only way you could reach him was by telephone. And so everyone had to know where he was all the time, even when we were on holiday, on vacation, you know. He had to make sure he checked in all the time. So that's quite confining, and not only physically, but certainly mentally. As much as I could, I tried to get out of my mother. over a long period of time, actually. It took a while for her to open up. She doesn't know. She didn't. There's no small, simple answer as to why he became a serial adulterer. Yet he came back, and she took him back, and was determined never, ever to give him a divorce. And
it's going to be a war of attrition.
That's right. That's right. And so, and she, you know, she remained loyal to him for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
I think she wanted very, like many, many people still do and did then, but many women, especially at that time, wanted to keep the family together. What was she going to do with four children?
Well, I was going to say, yeah, that's, you know.
As simple as that sounds, it's not, because when you live with that all the time, you know.
Well, and also, no one, as you say, yes, this was the 60s and 70s, but even in New York, nobody got divorced, you know, really until the 70s. So certainly no, you know, it was not, you were the scourge of the community.
Yes.
You know, you,
yes.
Jezebel, et cetera, you know,
yes.
Except that she didn't really have an option.
I don't know how they survived all of the scandal in that small town. I don't know how they did it. I
yeah.
really don't. That was tough.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Okay, so let's get back to that, because Miss Agnes of the Red.
Yes.
Miss Agnes of the Red. You know, eventually dies, and she leaves your father her massive pile of a mansion.
Yes. It's an historical mansion, because a Revolutionary War hero bought it, and he was a slave owner. Mm-hmm. And he owned more slaves in Kentucky than I think any other person at that time. He owned over 100 slaves. So this home comes with quite a history. And she was a history lover. And so after 13 years of living in a funeral home, I moved into this antebellum mansion in the residential neighborhood. The will was contested by a lawyer that my father had a disagreement with about, of all things. And the solicitor contested the will. He contacted the nephew of Miss Agnes, who was still alive, and got him involved. And after we won each decision, until it finally was appealed and taken to the Supreme Court of Kentucky, and we lost.
Was that due to corruption?
Gosh, I can't say.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed... It was clear, and you'd won every single thing, and he basically made his life's work to hound you out of your home.
Yes.
It's disgusting.
Yes. The court case was ongoing while he was dying. And, in fact, it was not... the decision did not come down from the courts until after his death, mm-hmm. so he never knew.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to die not knowing what was going to happen to mm-hmm. us and to the house. And and he was very, very ill. He had pancreatic cancer.
Now I want to turn to you.
You sound like my editor.
Now back to the beam on Kate. Because while it's... You know, you're becoming a teenager in this town.
Mm-hmm.
And also while, you know, sort of certain aspects of your sort of godlike view of your father is becoming tarnished, you become quite rebellious
Yes, I didn't think of it as being rebellious, though. That was, I probably didn't even know the word at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was drawn to an African American boy. In all ways, not just physically or romantically or anything like that. It was just I was curious, and he was interesting to me, and not because he was black. It wasn't that I'm really interested in black boys. No, it wasn't that. He was just a person. Because remember, I'd grown up with Belle,
mm-hmm.
who was our African American housekeeper, who I adored absolutely adored.
And much closer to than your mother.
Yes, yes. In some ways. Mm. I mean, she also, Belle also, there was that thing that I don't know if you saw The Help, or read The Help, but, you know, that when I saw that film and read the book and the scene where she's trying to get her to sit down to eat lunch with her, that was so genuine and so authentic, because that's exactly what happened with the character of Belle in my book. It was, you know...
Yeah, there was line drawn on both sides.
Yes, exactly. But so I didn't understand prejudice, and I didn't understand segregation. I just didn't see what all the hoopla was about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And certainly didn't understand the hatred. Mm-hmm. It distressed me.
The fear, the hatred.
But I didn't know anyone else who felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very lonely.
Mm. And if your parents had known, I mean, propelled you all the way to London.
Yes, eventually. Like, who knew?
Exactly. How did you end up here?
I was living in New York at the time. I'd gone to school there. And a friend of mine was British, and she had a brother. And I met him, and the rest is history.
Mm, wonderful. And your husband, I believe, has run a haberdashery?
Yes, he was. Yeah. He was in the fashion, men's fashion business. Two trips a year to Italy, two trips a year to Paris, that kind of thing. Mm. Yeah.
Pretty fabulous. Yeah. Yes. And I wanted to get into it because you, there's a one aspect of the book. You always went in and saw the bodies after your father did his work. And he never let anyone in. That was his job. That was his reverence and his thing. But you always went in afterwards. And you could always feel if they were there or if they weren't.
Yes, I had an experience, but it wasn't until I was a teenager, I think, or just before. And I'd seen a lot of dead bodies by then.
They'd racked up.
Yeah, and it was one night when I used to play the organ. And I used to have organ and piano lessons, and the only time I could practice was at night. So I would go downstairs after all the people left, and after I practiced, I was responsible for locking up and, or actually, you know, turning out all the lights and that kind of thing. And so one night after I finished playing, I went in to look at who was dead, and I stood by the casket, and it was just the strangest feeling. I felt that there was something or someone in the room. And I never saw anything. There was never any question in my mind of it being a ghost or anything like that. But there was a presence. And it scared me. It really scared me. And I'd never been frightened in the funeral home before. I'd been a little turned off by the embalming, that aspect of it. But that didn't frighten me. It was a different feeling. But this time, I was really frightened.
Mm.
And so I screamed for my father, and he came down, and he just couldn't believe it. He just thought, you know, what is going on?
After all these years, yes. You know, you've been living in it.
After all these years, I can't believe it. And so he made me stand there with him to say, okay, all right, here we are. What are you afraid of? And I couldn't say. I was embarrassed, and I didn't want him to think I was kind of crazy or anything, so I just said nothing. I'm not afraid of anything. But then the next night I did it again. I went downstairs after everyone had left. He was still there. It was a two-nighter. And I felt it again, and I felt it immediately. And then it got to where I didn't even have to wait until the night. I could go in the morning before I went to school, and I felt sometimes nothing, but then sometimes, every once in a while, I felt it's like a veil is dropped over you and everything stops and everything's quiet and still, whether it is or not. And the air feels heavy, and the air feels thick, and that's what makes you feel like there's a presence, because you feel that the air feels different and the atmosphere feels different. And then it goes. And then that's when I thought, okay, that's time to move on and stop doing this and time to be interested in other things. and
more life, less death.
Yes, not spend quite as much time in the funeral home.
And yet, I read at the end of the book, you're talking about a death movement and death societies. Do you think we need to talk more about death and sort of redress the balance a bit?
I do.
Why?
I mean, I don't mean that... I'm not advocating everyone go to a death cafe or, you know. But I think the taboo is being lifted a bit because there are these death cafes. And in New York, I hear there's death suppers. Have you heard that?
No.
Yes, death suppers.
What takes place in a death
cafe? Okay, well, it's not gruesome at all. And it's not ghoulish. People are genuinely sitting around talking about the one that I attended, we were asked, what would you like your death to be like?
Mm-hmm.
So people who've never even thought about dying are suddenly thinking about, okay, well, I'm going to die one day. How do I want it to be? And then other people in the... who are in the profession attend these cafes, and they tell people what it's like to work in the death profession, what it's like, what happens.
What the processes
are like. So, yes, so you're informed.
Yeah.
So it's about informing and also expressing something that you may feel or an experience that you've had.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe your mother died very badly and you want, or she had some kind of awful hospital experience or something. So the only way we can make those things better is to talk about them and see what is out there to make them better.
Right.
And so that's really what I experienced at the death cafe that I attended.
Fantastic. This is Kate Mayfield reading from The Undertaker's Daughter.
Come the autumn, when school began again, we entered our elementary classroom and were assigned seats. At times we were given a choice, but were more often told to sit alphabetically. I always sat behind Linda Mayberry. One wouldn't notice her. In a classroom filled with 20 or so children born of farmers, factory workers, doctors and teachers, and me, the undertaker's daughter, it was unusual not to know what Linda Mayberry's father did for a living. But no one bothered to ask. I sat behind her year after year and therefore became intimate with her back. Her hair was coarse and the color of burned wheat. It fell in tight, fuzzy curls just above her shoulders. Midway through the afternoon, we noticed the lifeguards were acting strangely during the break. We waited for the whistle to blow, the signal that allowed us back into the water. But the whistle didn't blow again that day. Linda Mayberry was missing. They found her at the bottom of the pool, tucked away in a corner in fetal position. She was curled up into such a small little ball that the lifeguard didn't see her until she dove in for the hourly pool check. The 11-year-old wasn't a good swimmer and seemed to have wandered off to the deep end of the pool and quite simply sunk down without a ripple. My father was called and brought Linda Mayberry to our house. As was our custom, I was allowed to see her after he had performed his duties, before her family arrived, and before the townspeople came to pay their respects to a girl they barely knew. Someone had donated a bright new dress, probably the first previously unworn dress she'd ever received. Mildred, the beautician, tamed her hair. This was one of those occasions upon which my father was expected to perform better than his best. And she did indeed resemble herself. The same straight lip line, the long lashes intact. But the quietness that now encompassed her was not her own. And death at her young age made her look artificial. Not since I had touched that first dead body years ago had I any desire to do so again. I recall that I had placed my hand on the lapel of the deceased man's jacket because I didn't want to feel his skin. Yet now I had a strong, startling urge to touch her face, to kiss it goodbye. The dead face of Linda Mayberry was already haunting me. Perhaps because I'd gazed at the back of her head for so many years on the day of her viewing, as I stood before her casket for a few short moments, I could not let her go.
Kate Mayfield, thank you so much. The Undertaker's Daughter is a fantastic read,
aside from
anything else, and you've been wonderful.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you. Very nice to meet you.
This is a Radio Gorgeous podcast made for RadioGorgeous.com, produced and presented by Donna Freed and edited by Anna Palankis.